Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNPlus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNPlus. And don't forget to go to my landing page. We're up to this point. The 79 previous podcasts are there for your binging enjoyment as we prepare for episode 80. And I am very excited to welcome my next guest here. This is somebody who I've wanted to talk to for a very long time. I've been listening to him on the radio, watching him on television and in movies, and just based on the information that I've seen, I've often joked that we may be twin sons of different mothers. Welcome to the show, Mr. Artie Lang.
Hey, what's up?
Not much. So you are, as usual, a busy guy. I just saw on television now, you are a part of the most popular, I guess voted by people on, you know, on 2020 or something. You're in the most popular Christmas movie of all time?
Yeah, I'm the original Santa, Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when did you do that movie? I never saw you in It's a Wonderful Life. Are you Mr. Gower?
I play the wife.
Oh my goodness!
I'd love to play Mr. Potter, but Mr. That's the only time I could do a good impression of Jimmy Stewart is saying Mr. Gower. But Mr. Gower, Mr. Gower.
Don't you know me? No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, you know, that gibberish you're speaking has been, as we say, unseated as the most popular Christmas movie ever by a little picture I did called Elf.
Now,
yeah.
When you did that, I remember you talking about that. Did you even have any clue the mega, you know, project that would be? It's a musical. I mean, it's grown into like this amazing thing. And you did that one shot thing. Did you have any idea what this would become? Or are you doing a favor for somebody?
No, there was no favors. I wasn't capable of doing favors. But my career is like I need a favor, then I can do somebody a favor, then I need two favors, then I can do somebody one favor back, and then I'm out of the business. Listen, The Elf was the third thing I had done with Will Ferrell. And Will and I, we were in three projects. One was Unknown Bomb called Boat Trip, which we shot in Cologne, Germany. But it's the first time we really met. And he wasn't, you know, Will Ferrell yet, the movie star. And I wasn't the full scumbag I've become. And we hit it off. And we went out, you know, Cologne, Germany is like a classier, more low-key version of Amsterdam. And we went bar hopping the night before and stayed out till 5 a.m. the night before we had to do a 17-hour day of shooting.
Isn't that how most of your stories go? This sounds very familiar.
Not with Will Ferrell at the end and Cuba Gooding Jr. We literally were hungover for 17 hours, but he was so funny. The movie's not great, but he was so hilarious. We play gay lovers. I'm not even kidding. And at the end of the scene, we have to kiss, and I said, where are we kissing? On the lips? And they said, yeah. I said, well, that's not happening. I'm telling you right now just because I'm not homophobic, but I have uncles that are, and I want to see them on Thanksgiving. So they said, you won't have to do it. I fly to Cologne, Germany. Will's there. Will do anything for a laugh. And the director says, okay, you're going to kiss him on the lips. I said, I told you. You wasted all your money. And Will is trying to push me towards him, and I look repulsed by him, and that's what that's what I was trying to look like. They finally let it be where he kissed me on the cheek, and he's so funny it worked. It would have been funny the other way, but I can still talk to my uncles, and we were happy. That movie bombed. But the next movie is a movie called Old School. And
I booked
a supporting role in that and a couple of scenes with Will, and we just always had fun. So, you know, about a year later, I get a call that they're going to do a Christmas movie, and Will is playing an elf. And, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, how does that sound? He's like, okay, I guess I'm doing him a favor.
Well, you know, I had done 2 years earlier when I had a brief film career. I was doing a film called The Bachelor with Chris O'Donnell and Renee Zellweger. We shot it up in San Francisco, and Ed Asner is in that. And he's also the other Santa in Elf.
Right.
And I said, well, yeah, well, there's a connection. We hit it off. Maybe that's it. But I said, more likely Will wants me to do this. And Favreau, I kind of knew. And sure enough, Will said, you know, the Santa that I get into the fight with where we destroy the place, I work with Artie a couple of times. I was on Stern at this point.
Yeah.
He goes, see if you can get a couple of days off because I had to go to Vancouver. So Will, you know, actually requested that they get me and badgered them till they hired me. And I got to tell you, I didn't even audition. And it has become like every Christmas I get a royalty. It's like, it's unbelievable. They run marathons of it.
Yeah. My favorite character is actually Leon, the snowman.
Right.
You know, Leon Redbone.
Yeah. I love it.
I love it.
There's a lot of funny ideas in that movie.
Yeah.
Like you look at it, it's quirky and stuff like that works almost like a Christmas story, you know? And I loved being in it. But the greatest part about working with Will is he really does seem crazy. And I'm crazy all the time, but he acts that way. I'm really crazy. But we have this sort of rapport. I get to Vancouver, and the wardrobe woman, we have a long day. They're going to be $20,000 a day, so they want to be done in one day. So I can't get the Santa outfit on. It doesn't fit me. I'm actually too fat for a Santa outfit. And we're getting the leg in, and I'm trying to make small talk with the girl. And, again, she's a local from Vancouver. And I said, what is this place? Yeah. And she goes, it was an old insane asylum. And as she said that, right on cue, Will walked back full in the elf cap and everything, went, hi, Artie. And kept walking. It was, he had to be in the character all day, because otherwise he'd lose it. So at lunch he would be, can I have some oatmeal, Artie? Like in that character with the cap and the curly shoes. She goes, it's an old insane asylum. And a second later, hi, Artie. You know, it was surreal.
It's Santa.
It was a blast. And the kid who sits in my lap, he was the best kid actor ever. He laughed at everything. And he would be 21 years old right now. I told him, try to find that kid.
Right.
I guess they couldn't. It would be great if he's actually in an insane asylum.
Right. you've often said that you belong in one, so that was, you probably felt right at home, right?
Yeah, you know, I tell people that I've been in I've led a full life. I've been in jail, and I've been in mental institutions. And people say, what would you rather be in? And I'd much rather be in jail, because in jail, you have logical conversations, and that's all you want if you're incarcerated. Like, here's the difference, the way they talk. In jail, people say, I needed money, so I stole a car. In a mental home, here's how people talk. They say, I needed money, so I had sex at the mall.
Well, what's your hat trick? What's your third place? You need a third one now.
My third place would be a hockey game and have sex with the hockey. Honestly, I haven't hit the third yet, so that means I got more to live. I thought, you know, this business, even when stuff bombs, with my relationship with Will, it's fun. It's fun being around funny people. So, you know, it's been a blast. And Elf to be classic enough to get a special on ABC is crazy.
Well, you know, it's amazing how, I mean, you wouldn't expect, especially a movie that is relatively new. I mean, when did that movie come out?
You know what? 15 years ago.
Wow, it's that old already.
But yeah, you still, exactly.
But still, you would never expect it to unseat a movie like you said, Miracle on 34th Street, or It's a Wonderful Life, or White Christmas.
Well, I didn't see the special. I don't know the premise of the special. Are you telling me that's why we're in there? I didn't know we became the most popular. Is that
true? I think they're voting. The whole special is about voting for the...
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so
that's great.
Yeah, so I think that's what it is. So what, you mean...
We're like the Kelly Clarkson of Christmas movies.
Yeah, you're going to be like Rosemary Clooney now.
I'd rather be like George Clooney, but that's fine.
Hi-yo. But I probably started a little prematurely here, but Artie Lang, one of the most in-demand comedians, and obviously has had one of the most interesting careers, either by design or by happenstance. Not sure which one, but certainly it is filled with some amazing stories, some incredibly high and some incredible, no pun intended, and some incredibly low. But certainly a very interesting. Got your start, for the most part, for most people would see you during on Mad TV. I remember you on the, I used to love the Norm Show, and I do remember you on that show.
thanks.
Yeah, I always still Norm is one of my my favorite guys. And then it was so cool to actually I listened. I'm a huge Howard Stern fan, so I've been listening to Howard for more than 25 years. And so I literally heard your first appearance on that show when you walked
with
in
Norm.
With Norm, and you could just see that that Howard was kind of perplexed and yet completely enthralled with with your stories of cocaine use and pig noses. I mean, you were the perfect foil. And then obviously Dirty Work with Norm. And what's funny, I just thought about it. So you've worked with both Don Rickles in Dirty Work and with Bob Newhart. I mean, you didn't work with Bob Newhart, but Bob Newhart's an Elf. So you actually worked with those two, you know, in the same, you know, movies with those two guys.
Yeah, I actually did meet Bob Newhart.
Oh, you did?
He was on the set doing a different scene than me.
Oh, cool.
And I went out of my way to say hi to him. It's like in that movie, The Bachelor, I mentioned before, it was Peter Ustinov's last movie, and I said, I got to meet Peter Ustinov. So I went to the set that day. But same thing with Newhart. I was so enamored.
Yeah.
He was, it was really cool to see him say F off to somebody in that subtle way.
And
now, he was so cool.
Yeah, now one of your current projects is once again, I sort of by happenstance, as I joked before, but really not. You have been appearing regularly now in the HBO comedy called Crashing, starring Pete Holmes. This is the second season, and it starts on January 14th on HBO. Now, it's true that you sort of were just going to kind of do a cameo, and you had such good chemistry, or they just enjoyed what you were doing and the quasi character you were playing yourself. To some extent, or a great extent.
Now in the beginning, changed to that.
Right, but then all of a sudden they said, hey, we need you, and so you did a great a bulk of the first season you appeared in, and now you're going to be appearing in season two.
Yeah, it was funny. I had met Judd Apatow when he was shooting Trainwreck with Amy Schumer, because he was actually, what a work ethic he has. It's unbelievable. He was directing Trainwreck all day, and then he would go into the city in the village to go to the Comedy Cellar and work on his stand-up, because he started as a stand-up. And I think working with Amy and everything and all the stand-ups that are in that movie kind of inspired him, and he had such success where you could go, hey, let me try stand-up again. Every night after he shot a day of work on the movie, he came into the cellar. And it happened to me when I was working on a special. And I saw him every night, and we had sort of small talk, and he was very nice. And that's how I met him. He had my book. He had my first book, which was very flattering. And so I think he thought of me the next year for a very small role. It was literally like a couple of sentences, but it was something where you'd see my face in an HBO show. And because it was Judd having a great career and being friendly with him the year before, I said, I'll go in. Otherwise, I wouldn't have, because quite frankly, I don't have time. I have a very
very busy guy.
So I'm busy trying to find my feet in the shower, so I couldn't go with anybody else. But I said, for Judd, I'll do it. So I go in, and it's just Pete there. And I walked in. I was very funny from the beginning. I said, I thought this was Larry Holmes, and that would have been much funnier. I love Pete, but to this day, I think Larry Holmes would be funnier.
Hi-yo! And, wow!
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I sit down, and it's two lines in this thing. And again, me and Pete look like Laurel and Hardy. It helps the visual.
Right.
And just a couple lines, it kills. And I realize, hey, you know, there is some sort of chemistry here. I went out with a good experience. A few days go by, and I told my agent, I said, you know, I thought I was going to get a call back, but I guess not. That night, the reason they waited so long was Judd wanted to come in because he wanted to be in the next audition, and he said, I wanted to be Artie as Artie, and I'm going to yell out stories from his book, and he should just tell them.
Wow.
So, my God, what an advantage. So the character changes not only the name Artie, but me, Artie
right.
Lang.
Yeah.
And we tell stories, and I told a couple, totally improvising. And Judd said, okay, you're going to be in the pilot, and you're going to play you. I said, that's great. Two rehearsals later, my friend, the name of the pilot was Artie Lang.
Right, yeah. I remember seeing that. I remember seeing that on my program guide. It's like, wow. I mean, you know, the star of the show's name isn't that prominent.
Well, it's it's one of those things that because I was on the biggest radio show ever, I'm probably a little more known than him. But he's such a talent, and people love him. And Judd, again, he's got that golden touch. He touched them, and of course, Louis C.K. touches people in a different way. But Judd, we can edit that out. But Judd, I'm working on a character, the most liberal person ever, Ashley Judd Apatow.
There you go. Well, you know, it's funny about crashing too. Now I'm calling you from, I believe it's your home. Is there anybody on your couch right now? Because the whole concept of that show is how comedians basically, especially when they're starting out, they don't have a place to live, or if they're on the road, sometimes they have a place.
I gotta tell you, I'm looking at the couch over the years. If you could somehow get a scientist to connect a bunch of different germs, you'd have the funniest person ever.
There's a lot of DNA there, huh?
A lot of DNA, but also germs, a lot of dead guys, a lot of guys who are alive but should be dead. No, Dan Filato has been on the couch for 5 years now.
Yeah, well, and that's where he belongs.
No, you know, I it's empty because I've become very, very mean to people. I can't, I've been burned by a lot of not just comedians, but friends from the past who come in, and I think I'm going to get rent and they take the television.
You know who Pete Holmes...
I wish I did.
You know who Pete Holmes reminds me of? Because I've watched the show. He reminds me of John Ritter. He looks like John Ritter, and he kind of talks and acts, and he has that same kind of John Ritterish.
Right.
I mean, I'm waiting for Joyce DeWitt and Suzanne Somers to come popping out of a room somewhere sometime. But...
Well, it'll be the first DeWitt on this show.
Yeah. but he does remind me of him. Yeah.
He looks like John Ritter, and coincidentally enough, the pilot's based on this. When he walked in on his wife and a teacher, they said, "Three's company."
There you go.
No, I'll tell you. A lot of people say that. How about this Val Kilmer? They think he looks like Val Kilmer.
Oh, yes. When Val Kilmer didn't weigh 300 pounds.
Well, he did eventually.
Val Kilmer.
Did you see Wonderland?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, yeah, my gosh. Yeah, because now he's gone the other way.
The Secret Island of Dr. Moreau. Did you see that?
Oh, my gosh. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, hey, I'm doing a sequel called The Studio Apartment of Dr. Moreau.
Who's going to play the little guy?
You know what? That's going to be played by Pete. It's very good. A hard job of acting.
And so now,
Dinklage.
There you go. Yeah, because you know whatchamacallit, Game of Thrones is going to be done in a year. He's going to need some work.
You know what? I don't give guys passes just because they have an affliction. Here's the headline of my review of Game of Thrones: Peter Stinklage.
Oh, wow!
That's like a New York Post headline. Yeah, because I've gotten a few. I've been in 14 movies. I have a total of one star.
When you put them all together.
Yeah, Jesus. That's why Crashing is great, because it gets good reviews. I love being in it because I'm part of Judd's world, and he gets good reviews, and it's so much fun. I did two seasons. I'm what they consider a regular on a show nowadays if you're not the star. To save money, you're in like 6 of 8 episodes. But that's fantastic, because if you're on something you like doing, you go in and out, and this has been a blast.
And have they talked? I mean, because have they talked about another season, or are they still debating?
Yeah, they've talked about another season, not to me, but they have.
Yeah,
I think it will. You know, look, they like being in business with Judd, and his show was very successful. Girls,
oh, sure.
is off the air, which means Lena Dunham will be running for president, and she's got my vote. I think they want to be in business with the great Judd Apatow, and we're benefiting from that because he made great shows. And Pete, really, I'll tell you, all joking aside, I mean, what a work ethic, and he's really good at what he does, and he made great shows, and we want to be in business with HBO because they let us give, you know, a lot of leeway to Pete. We took chances, and hopefully it'll get a third season. The rumbling is good.
And so now you have been doing a variety of radio shows and different podcasts.
Podcast.
And now you're doing a new one with Anthony Cumia from the Anthony and Opie fame.
Yeah, Opie and Anthony.
Well, I figured I'd say his name first.
You know, the show with me now is called Opiate and Anthony.
But so you get top billing, though, right? It's Artie and Anthony, right?
Yeah, and look, I didn't go in. A lot of people think I'm a jerk, and I insisted on that. I did not do that. Anthony is a very nice, gracious guy, and they told me in their marketing department that it flows better that way. So what am I? I'm not an expert.
Well,
I'm fine with it.
You know, it's funny though. Now that we're talking about this, so let's take a little trip back here. So you were going to do a quick cameo on Crashing, and you wound up being in more than half the episodes, and the pilot episode was named after you.
Right.
You were doing a radio show with a guy named Nick DiPaolo. It was his radio show. You wound up being his sidekick, and then you replaced him, and he was gone. And and now
plan worked.
You went to talk to you did some work with Anthony, and suddenly you are doing a show with him, and your name gets first billing. There's definitely a a pattern here, whether you know it or not.
Well, be careful. By the end of this interview, this is going to be called the Artie Toronto.
I know. I swear to God, I'm afraid already.
Artie in Toronto. What people learn when they work with me is sometimes talent is hard to keep in a cage. And my wings are too beautiful to keep
Hey, boy, you know, could I use that? I love that line because I'm accused of the same.
I made that up.
Well, I might steal that. I love that. What was it again? Talent is what?
My talent is
too
good. You know what? I'll email it to you.
You know what? I'm gonna put that in the bottom of my emails now.
I made that up, and I made up the phrase, hurry up and wait.
There you go. Well, you know, the one thing that I want to talk about, too, briefly, you mentioned your first book, which was Too Fat to Fish, and then you had the follow-up, Crash and Burn. Both were very successful.
If you call debuting number one on the New York Times bestseller successful, that's fine.
Okay, ding, ding, ding. There's a plug for that.
Thank you.
The thing about Crash and Burn, that one, I literally read that on one plane ride.
On
a 4-hour plane ride.
Thank you.
I really could not put that down. And one of the reasons why I couldn't put it down, because it reminded me of a book that's actually one of my favorite books. And I wonder if when you were putting together Crash and Burn, because this does tell a very gripping story about your career and your drug addictions and how it affected your, your personal life as well as your career. And it reminded me of John Belushi's Wired book that Bob Woodward
wrote. Right.
It was different in that was more recollections of other people, where this was your story. But I know you're a big Belushi fan, and so I wondered when you were we were coming together to put this book together and thinking about all the things, and it's a brutally honest book, and you're certainly exposing yourself. Were you thinking of the Belushi experience or the Belushi book at all?
No, you know, it's a good question. I mean, Belushi was only 33 when he died. It's, like, unbelievable. I think of that, and I'm 50 years old, and I have 17 years on him when he died, and that's so young when you look back on it. And the last film Belushi did was Dirty Work, the film I did. The last scene he ever shot in a movie was with me, and he was such a hurricane of talent, man. He was unbelievable, and I got to work with him, which is great. But he sort of showed me the ropes inadvertently without knowing about what not to do. But he was just someone's going to have to literally cage him. He was that way on the stage, too. Unfortunately, that's what made him funny on some level. But what he didn't realize was he didn't need any drugs or booze to be funny. He was just a natural talent. And it's depressing that guys like that don't find that out. I mean, Belushi was 33. Chris Farley was 33. And Jesus was 33. And I said, you guys had a lot left to do. Now, I was when I met Farley, I was 29, and we talked about Belushi all the time. And when I wrote the book, I tried desperately to keep John Belushi out of my mind because I didn't want it to be like a copycat. But I think it was you see, I'm influenced by it, but, also it's my story. He was the greatest, and I had to avoid I didn't want critics to ever compare me.
Right, right.
But ultimately, Too Fat to Fish was a good experience and almost an homage in some ways to Belushi, you know?
Well, I was in high school. I was a senior in high school. I'll never forget the day. It was 1982 when he died, and
March 5th. I remember. I was in ninth grade too.
Yeah, I was a senior in high school, and I was a huge, huge Belushi fan, big blues brother, you name it, you know.
Yeah.
And the thing when I read Wired a couple years later, and even though it was criticized by many of Belushi's friends like Aykroyd and things because they felt that, he didn't. you know, he didn't pay enough homage, or that you know, he they took.
Well, you know, I think I saw what they were talking about in the sense that it was written by, you know, Bob Woodward, obviously the conservative end of the Watergate guys with Bernstein, and I think he couldn't relate to the drug part, and that's what fascinated him, so that's what he focused on. But the artists in Belushi's life, like Aykroyd and all those guys, knew him on that end, and they were mad he didn't concentrate on his brilliance.
Exactly.
You know, it's a hard thing to tackle, you know.
But the thing that struck me, you know, as a guy that was, 18 or 19, 20 years old, when that book came out, to your point, was that the drugs had taken such a control of his life that here was easily one of the funniest guys ever, if not.
Right.
And right. And he was in such a drug infused you know, bubble,
yeah,
that
he had lost it.
He
yep.
did, but he didn't think he was funny anymore. You know,
how awful. I know. It,
yeah, and I said to myself, "My gosh, in fact, that's one thing that actually helped me to get a little scared straight even before you know, even before you know, the 80s were around when I was in my
20s. A lot of people said that.
And I said, I said, my God, if John Belushi, if you know, because at that time, I you know, cocaine was just beginning and I wasn't
right.
You know, experimenting yet. But I said, my God, if that does that to this guy, and that he didn't think it was funny, man, I don't know if I should even get close to that stuff, because what a shame. You have this comic genius who actually didn't think he was funny anymore. And there's a lot, while you don't get to that point in your book, there are some similarities in, you know, the depths that you went. And you are very honest about it, and that's what made that book so so gripping.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was hard to go into that. And a lot of people ask me, why did I write a second book? And the answer is simple: for $800,000.
and so it was cathartic, but it was also good for your bank account too.
You know, I know what first of all, you know, all joking aside, I know what you're saying. It's depressing when you hear that. Every funny person I've ever known thinks they suck. You know, but you know, it's all BS, because if you say you want to be a comedian, if you actually walk into a comedy club with some notes written down and try to be a comic, you don't think you suck. It's fake humility. In other words, you know, you're telling people by trying it that not only do I think what I have to say in my head and the way I say it is funny and interesting, I think people will pay $14 for a Bud Light and watch it. You know, it's really arrogance just to try it if you think about it.
Well, that's yeah. But, I've even said, you know, that about radio. You've got to be a narcissist and you've got to have a crazy ego to think that you're going to go on a microphone and talk and people are going to think you're interesting.
Well, radio to me is a perfect combination of humility and not humility, because radio is someone who thinks they're funny but too ugly to be on TV.
Have you seen me? Have you seen me?
No, I'm sad. I'm not present company accepted.
No, I'm
joking. You seen me?
But well, one thing, and once again, where I was compelled is because, like I said, I have been a fan of yours. You know, I listened to your entire tenure, your entire run from literally day one until the last day on Howard Stern. And I saw the way your role, you know, emerged and changed and became in many ways dominant and much different than, you know, the so-called Jackie chair. You certainly were not in the Jackie chair toward the end of your run there. But I was wondering, too, when you talk about, you know, writing some jokes down and going in front of people, did working on the Howard Stern show help you find your comic voice, or were you always telling you know personal stories and then making them interesting, or the fact that on Howard's show you're almost pressed into duty of being honest and talking about things that you may never have expected to talk about or certainly expected to reveal to a huge nationwide audience, did that show help you with your comic voice, or was that comic voice already there?
Well, I being on the Howard Stern show helped me find a very nice shore house. Now, I you know, obviously, comedy is like a defense mechanism. That's an excellent question, because I got to tell you, it was a fine line to walk. you know, you're obviously a fan, and you know, you're a humorist, and you understand what people try to do, and when they try to make something their own. The Jackie chair was something that I was honored by because I love Jackie, and the show, in my opinion, it wasn't better or worse. I just think it was different, and what I did was different, and Howard was smart enough to see that. I wasn't a guy who could write in Howard's voice spontaneously. Jackie was, and Howard saw that, and I wrote stuff in the beginning, and Howard wasn't saying any of it, and it scared the hell out of me. But inadvertently, I failed upwards in the best way I could ever humanly imagine. I mean, he came to me after my stuff was bombing, and Gary said, me and Howard want to talk to you after the show. And I'm like, oh, God, they're going to fire me. And I walk in there, and again, you know, the greatest thing ever happened. They said, look, the stuff's not working when you write for Howard. And I'm like, I know, I'm sorry. So, listen, we're going to keep your mic on all the time. So just the stuff you thought about is very good when it comes out of your mouth. So, I think it'll be great if you just say it. And if I don't respond, just don't worry about it. And there you go. Because I sucked at writing, I got a gig. And literally, that's the last note they gave me for 8 years. And then after that, I just went on, and something with me and Howard clicked, and I was able to just talk and be funny in a way I never thought of, and it was kind of very simple. The guys going for that chair were very talented guys. I mean, you know, not that all of them wanted it, but people like Rogan and Chappelle and Jimmy Kimmel and Dave Attell, they all went in there, and a lot of them wanted to get the job. I was not as funny as a lot of those guys, but what I had on them was I knew the show better than any of them. I knew that for a fact because I've been listening forever. My old man turned me on to it. The show was very personal to me, you know, and I was able to use my comedy that I couldn't use anywhere else on that show to reach the most people. Someone said at 9:12 in the morning, New York time, like 14 million people were listening to it or something like that. And I think about telling a story about how, you know, my high school gym teacher had nice breasts, and he was a man. And a guy in traffic going to work in Missouri might be laughing at that, and it's helping his day. And I get a lot of people say, you got me through bad days. You know, honestly, you know this better than anybody because of radio and you're a fan. It was surreal. It was just completely and utterly surreal. I'd been in show business for 5 years. I had done Letterman, Conan. Never thought I'd meet someone as big, in my mind, as Howard. When I walked in there, Scott the Engineer was, in my opinion, the biggest celebrity I ever met in my life. And Renee Zellweger and I had lunch for 3 years. It was the only thing I rose up to the occasion. Jeff Ross, you know Jeff Ross?
Oh, yeah, the roaster, yeah.
He put it brilliantly. He said, look, I had sort of like gone in and out. He's a very funny comedian, but when he roasted Drew Carey on Comedy Central that first night, he said, I found my Yankee Stadium. It was like I found something comics dream to find, their niche. And the first couple of weeks on Howard, I found my Yankee Stadium. That was it. It was the best time of my life.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, because what's interesting about, and now your stand-up, you know, you've certainly, your life has certainly afforded you some great material.
Right.
So,
absolutely.
Yeah, you once again don't have to write the jokes down. But I think what's interesting about your, like I said before, your comic voice, and I think why people enjoy seeing you or listening to you is because, you know, you do have that everyman kind of, you know, background.
Sure.
and your stories. But and you can be a hard ass and you can be cocky, but there is very similar to like you're talking about with Chris Farley. But there is this vulnerable side. You are very self-deprecating in that, you know, you're honest about it and yet you're able to be humble about it and make fun about it. At the same time, as I said, the vulnerability, I think, is what people like, is that you're able to make fun of yourself and be honest, make fun of other people. And it's almost like Don Rickles, where, you know, toward the end of his career, people wanted to be insulted by Don Rickles. It was a badge of honor.
Yeah, that great story that Don Rickles did me the biggest favor ever. I said, Don, you did the best favor you could do for a comic. You gave me my first Letterman set. Like when he goes off on me in the first scene of Dirty Work. Literally, there's a first scene I'm shooting in a major movie. I'm afraid of getting fired. Because if they're going to fire you, it's in that first week. They got you. But after 2 weeks, you're on film, so you got them. They'll hire people to keep you alive. But that first couple of days, I'm the new kid, and it's a buddy comedy, and the Sagiel's action, and Don Rickles, the great Don Rickles, who I loved, comes up to me, and because he couldn't memorize the lines, we just said, and so I didn't know what he was going to say, improv. Comes up to me, first scene, he goes, "Look at you, you baby gorilla." We laughed 22. Me and Norm laughed 20 straight times. I said, "We're not going to get the scene." If you rent the movie, Norm never didn't stop laughing. He's laughing in it. So Rickles had to appeal to that. Like, what are you laughing at? Because I called your friend the fat pig. At one point, we had to do it in sections because I was laughing. The last part, I don't know what you're doing. He goes, "He's talking to my belly because it has ice cream in it. He's talking to the ice cream." And we just laughed, and I told that exact story verbatim to Letterman, knowing he loved Rickles,
right.
And it killed. And, you know, again, I've been lucky enough to lead a very surreal life. The problem is, for my poor mom, is I'm all extremes. There's nothing in the middle. Like, I don't have a day at soccer where I won 3-2 and I could talk about it. It's either my mother's seen me play Carnegie Hall with standing ovation and a sold-out crowd. I sold it out in 2 hours. My mother was there that night, got interviewed by the local news. She saw me when I found out my book was number one on the New York Times bestsellers. But she also saw me, get heroin and cocaine pumped out of my stomach, and almost die. So there's that. My father was like that too. So there's guilt, and there's joy, and in the middle there is just nothing, because that's how I am. But I got to tell you, maybe you're this way because you take risks, you have this career. I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, I like it this way, and I think my mom does too. I don't know.
So now, I don't know if you can talk about this or not from a legal standpoint, but, some of the most recent You made headlines both related to Chicago here, because
yeah.
You did a show here, and the next night, rumor has it that you almost died. You know,
yeah,
after
that's not exactly true.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. I've learned that, but that was the next thing, and then obviously you got in trouble with the law. Now, is that something that is still hanging around, or has that been settled?
Well, again, Danny Filato actually came up with this analogy, and it's perfect about my life because he's had a front row seat to this madness, being my podcast producer and my life partner. But I
Is he your significant other at this point?
He's my significant other in the courtroom. Player to be named later.
Yeah.
He's been watching my life, and he said, you remember that there was a Bugs Bunny episode where he's walking down a sidewalk in New York, and he's singing, "She's the daughter of Rosie O'Grady."
He's got his eyes closed.
He steps on a girder from a construction site.
Right, and
the girder takes him up.
Yes.
And when you think he's gonna fall, right. Another girder comes. And that is what my life is. That's a perfect analogy. You think I'm gonna fall, another girder comes. I was looking at time because I don't have the best of records, and another girder came. I'm not exactly able to tell you what the girder's name was, but it had a vowel at the end, and I owed him something, and he owed me something. No, but that's what my life is. That has gone away, and I was very gracious to the wonderful people of the Hoboken Police Department.
Well, that's good.
And, I'm okay. But, again, health-wise, the doctor says, look, you should be fine. I don't know what to tell you. I'm lucky, man, but I'm rolling the dice a little too much, man.
Well, here's the thing, too. As I said, having listened to you for many years on the radio, and as I said, seeing a lot of your work in other mediums. As I joked at the beginning, I oftentimes say I'd love to sit down and meet with you, just because we share so many interests in not just like in a little way, but like the interests that like define us. I love Bruce Springsteen. I love the Honeymooners. I love John Belushi. And I love The Godfather. And even though I've been born and raised in Chicago, I bought a Yankees jacket in 1982 before I ever bought a Cubs jacket.
That's tough, man. Good for you.
And
good
so I've always been a Yankee fan. Now, that was obviously, you know, when I was growing up, that was the Reggie Jackson years. And, Yeah. And so, But so now tell me a little bit, I mean, you're born in New Jersey. I've done the pilgrimage. I've gone to Freehold and walked in Bruce's neighborhood. I've seen Bruce perform in Jersey, which you have to see if you're a Springsteen fan. And in a couple of weeks, I'm actually going to go to New York to see him on Broadway.
Good for you.
Yeah, so, but I'm just wondering, you've actually come to know him. How you talk about surreal. Here you are, just a fan for many years, and now you actually call him a friend. Isn't that correct?
Well, you know, first of all, this relates to the story with Bruce. Are you an American history guy? Do you know a little
bit
about American history?
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, I'll ask you this: who was president when we started this interview? I'm kidding. I had to throw that. I knew you'd laugh at that. No, honestly, okay.
It was Reagan, by the way.
Good. Hopefully, some will trickle down here. I'll tell you why that's a great question. You're from Chicago proper, like around.
Yes.
The city?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Northwest. Okay. Yeah.
So
I mean, right
Danny,
in the heart of Chicago.
So is Danny. Right. So is Danny Filato.
Oh yeah.
Now Danny is a guy who I met 5 years ago, and you know, we felt like kindred spirits, and we worked on a show together, and he was the perfect guy to produce his podcast, and now he's like my right hand man, and he's a big Springsteen fan. Now, to me, like, we talk about Bruce a lot, as you do if you're a fan, and I can't believe how much he can relate to those songs, not being from New Jersey. Like, I'm like, wow, like, that's amazing that he had a fan like that, not growing up in Jersey and from Illinois, which it can be very different. So, you know, you're the only other person I've met like that. I mean, it's obvious why I relate to him. You know, I had a younger girlfriend, my girlfriend who broke up with me about 5 years ago, and she was 28 years old, and I'm at the time 45, and she sees me weeping as Springsteen's putting the E Street Band into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and she looks at me and goes, why don't we have a Springsteen? Because she got to know me, obviously.
Right.
Why doesn't my generation have a Springsteen? I said, I'll tell you why, because you can't relate to anything. Do you have a Bentley like Jay-Z? Do you get all the bitches like Biggie Smalls? Do you relate to anything with the 15 gold teeth and Lil Wayne and Vanilla Ice? And do you know anybody named Vanilla?
Yeah. I know a few chocolates, but
these are talented guys, but at the end of the day, you're just dancing to a beat. Now, I understand why some other people relate to it, but Springsteen was our generation. He just spoke to you, and that combination with the talent of his songwriting. Yeah. I said, listen to his song Jungle Land. I said, that's like classical music to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end, we didn't have a lot in common. At the end, here's what we had in common. She was born on the same day I got my first DUI.
Oh, well, now that is so romantic.
Okay, I'm going to blow you away as a Springsteen fan. Now, everybody knew I was a Bruce fan from The Stern Show.
Right.
I won two karaoke contests singing Glory Days and Born to Run. I said, you guys, just stop. I got
right,
you down.
Right, right.
And I did the gravelly thing and everything. So they knew I was a fan. And somehow, because the show was so big, an homage to Howard and his success, Bruce knew I was a fan. Now, I heard that through the grapevine. After I went through my living hell and I hit rock bottom, I mean, I said, if that is a rock bottom, I don't know what is. I stabbed myself. I tried to, you know, drink. Now, I don't know if I was trying to kill myself, but I wanted to pass out. I wanted to feel different because my depression over the drug use got so bad. I said, I've achieved all these things, but I can't, you know, enjoy it. And other times in my life, Bruce songs got me out of that funk. You know, and it meant a lot to me. I also shared that with the show. One night, me and my mother would not let me out of her sight after I got out of rehab, and I couldn't, you know, I had to stay with her because of what I did just to make her happy that she could see me. One night, the phone rings, and we could hear the answering machine. Mm. We're having dinner. She made raviolis al dente. And here's what we hear. Hey, Judy, it's Bruce Springsteen. You know, I got Artie's number from a guy. I'll tell him about it. Don't call me back. I'll call you tomorrow. I just want to talk to him and see how he is. He sounds like one of my brothers. All right, Judy, be well.
Oh, okay. My God.
Now, me and my mother look up at each other, and she goes with a full mouth, was that Bruce Springsteen the singer? Oh, no, that was Bruce the landscaper that I grew up with.
The janitor.
So, right. So I go, we had his number on the caller ID. She goes, should we call him back? I go, no, Ma, you don't know the etiquette of being more famous. David Spade taught it to me. He goes, if I'm more famous than you, wait till I call you. Assume
right.
I'm busy.
That's a good philosophy.
Oh, I wish I could have put out an album of Spade ripping me on answering machines. The first time I texted him, I put LOL, and he goes, I'll tell you when something's funny. You're not texting a cheerleader. Great. So the same night, talk about efficiency. The next night, same exact time, we were both in the kitchen staring at the phone.
Right.
And same exact time almost, it rings. And now my heartbeat, at that point I had played Carnegie Hall. I had been, I did the Letterman, the Tonight Show. My heart starts beating like Bugs Bunny when he sees a hot bunny chick. Like it's coming out of my chest.
It comes out of the chest, right.
It rings, we see a call ID, it's him. I go, you answer it. And she goes, why? You answer it. And I realize I sound like a little kid. My mother's answering.
Right. But
she picks up the
like
phone.
Like a girl is calling you for the first time.
She picks up the phone and says, like, starts making small talk. I'm like, shut up. So he hands me the phone. She goes, Artie, it's Bruce Springsteen. Like, she's telling me my buddy wants to play stickball.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, thank you. And, man, I'm telling you, I've never been so nervous in my life. I picked up the phone and I said, hey, how you doing? And he goes, this is Artie? I go, yeah. He goes, this is Bruce. Jeez. I'm like, I know. And he goes,
cool.
I know you know. And we talked for an hour and a half.
Oh, how cool is that?
He told me about how he helped Neil Young and how, Nils is open about it. And I became great friends with Nils. That shows you, man. Sometimes you're afraid to meet your heroes. But with him, you know, he stood up to everything. You know?
Well, one of the reasons you're talking about, geez, well, how could somebody from from Chicago or from Illinois relate as opposed to being from New Jersey? But the way that I the reason why Springsteen's music is so important to me, and maybe it is the same for you, I was an only child. I've always sort of been looking for a big brother. With all my...
I mean, that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, and for me, I'm 53. Springsteen's, what, 68? So he's like 50.
I just turned 50, so yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, and so he was like 15 years older than me, and when I got into him, and I got Born to Run as one of my 15 or my 12 for a penny Columbia Records and Tape Club in 1975, okay? That's when I got Born to Run. So I was, in sixth or seventh grade. And the music really related to me because it was almost like he was that big brother that was going through stuff and telling me what's ahead giving me some advice and some, so he was almost always like the next step in my life. What he was doing was going to be another 5 years before. So he was almost like preparing a path for me, like, hey, look out for this or look for
you're
that.
Telling
this...
a story.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what music used to be. And if someone was great at it, I mean, I would tell my girlfriend about it, and my cousins who were that age, I would tell them about these albums were like stories, the songs connected, and how like Born to Run was all these kids can't wait to get out of town and they're going to be everything, they're going to be a big success. And then Darkness on the Edge of Town is those guys growing up and they didn't become anything. And my God, those songs tell a more depressing story. And, she kind of got that.
Right.
She loved Rosalita. She loved Thunder Road and everything by the end. And at the end, she loved The Ring I Bought Her and Left With. It's great to hear you talk like that because, comedians are so cynical. And I tell all these guys, like at the comedy store table, I'm like, guys, listen, I get it. I think everything's corny. I think Diane Cannon is funnier than Nick Cannon. I get it. But, there's got to be one thing in life, at least one thing that you're a little corny about, you're romantic about. And the one thing I'll say for sure is it's the music of Bruce Springsteen.
I don't even apologize for it. To be honest, about a couple years ago after Clarence Clemons died, if you remember on that tour, at least at the beginning of that tour, that he was actually showing a video of Clarence.
Right, I saw it during 10th Avenue to Freeze Out.
Yeah, and I saw the first show. I actually flew to Atlanta to see the first show of that tour, and I never expected this to happen to me at all.
Right.
But when he started to do that, he said, "If they're here, if we're here, they're here," kind of thing.
Right,
and then he showed the video, and I started crying. I was like, I never met Clarence Clemons. But that music and those stories and it had been such a major part of my life, and I've seen him in concert 60 some times.
Right.
I actually started crying, and I made no apologies for it, because I was like, hey, man, I knew this music meant something to me, but I never really knew how much it meant until that moment when that just completely, caught me by surprise that I would be that personally moved. That I felt like I lost somebody. you know, close to me.
I know. Yeah, you're looking at up on that screen. It really is sad, you know. And again, drugs ruining your life. I got to know Clarence Clemons. Clarence Clemons asked me to write the foreword, a dedication, a blurb for his book.
Wow.
Because my book had done well, and the Bruce thing and the publicity on Howard. He said, "Would Artie write a blurb?" And I said, "Yeah," reluctantly. And I thought of the best blurb that I could think of, and it was like I compared him to Babe Ruth. You know, I wasn't there when Babe Ruth got up, but I must admit it probably was a lot like Clarence Clemons doing the solo for Born to Run. A big man was walking up to do something that was going to make you cheer louder than you ever have in your life, and he loved it. And he said it moved him and everything. I doubt he even read it, but I was supposed to meet him. He goes, "Tell Artie I read it and I love him, and we're going to play the Garden. We'll be in New York. Can he come back and meet me?" And I said, "Yeah." And in some ways, it's even more cooler than Bruce, because I went through that, and now I'm going to meet Clarence Clemons. And I went into opiate withdrawals, and I was late. I couldn't make seeing him because of drugs, and he was dead a month later. He died across the street from me, because by that time I was in rehab on Singer Island down in Florida. I pick up the paper, and again, younger people, they don't know why it's so important. He died across the street from me in his house.
Wow.
I had missed meeting him. Yeah. Because I was doing drugs.
Yeah.
And, you know, what are you going to do? If that doesn't hit you in the head, nothing does. I saw Springsteen in Paris after that phone call. I went to, and you ever want to see something? 4 hours of them knowing every song in French. It's unbelievable. No air conditioning and they stink. But anyway, I see Springsteen at the after party. And he comes up and hugs me. This is classic Artie Lang, and I have to leave you with this because I got to go to work.
Yeah,
You're right. I did. I had way more fun than I thought I would, and we should do this again.
I would love to.
I'll leave you with this. Typical me and my life. Springsteen hugs me, and in person, in Paris, it's like romantic. I get to thank him. I say, "Thank you so much for that phone call. And Bruce, I think I beat heroin. You never say for sure, but I've been clean and sober now for 9 months," which was true. "Thank you so much for your help." And we talked a bit, and the last thing he said was, "Live long and prosper." And he walked away. 20 hours later, I was in a Paris jail for public drunkenness.
Oh, jeez.
20 hours later. Because my girlfriend doesn't listen. Anyway, I fell off the wagon because of a broad, and I'm in this Paris jail cell. I had no shirt on, because I lost it taking a swing at a gendarme. And I'm thinking of what a loser I am. Like, there's no – and a guy who was like the Otis from the Andy Griffith Show of Paris is sitting there in my face. And finally, moved his bowels and fell asleep, which was great.
Nice.
So I'm sitting there going, what if Springsteen – I mean, he might see this or hear about it.
Right.
Like, I just told him.
Right.
I just told him I'm fine. I beat it. And that is the long line of disappointment. I visited John Belushi's grave in Martha's Vineyard, okay? True story. Everybody left something there that was sort of edgy. Heineken bottles.
Right. Like Jim Morrison, yeah.
Right, exactly. I saw that in Paris, too.
Yeah.
I left half an eight ball of cocaine at Belushi's grave at 4 in the afternoon. At 4 in the morning, I came back to get it.
Oh. Well, the thought was there. At least the thought was there.
The thought. You know, I left some residue in the bag.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an edgy story.
Oh,
I could talk like this with you forever. I want to do it again.
I hope we will. I would love to. Because, like I said, we haven't even touched on our affinity for The Godfather and especially The Honeymooners. I don't know about you, but I did get a chance to meet Jackie Gleason, and that was...
Yeah. On the set of Nothing in Common?
Well, I was in Chicago. Yeah, he filmed it in Chicago. That's when I met him. I met him I had an internship at a TV station, and they were interviewing him because he was in town. And so I went up to his room at the Ritz-Carlton expecting the reporter and everyone else to be there. I knocked on the door. His wife answers, and she said, "Well, where's the camera crew?" And I said, "Well, aren't they here yet?" She said, "No." And I said, "Oh." And she said, "Well, come on in and say hi to Jackie."
Oh, wow.
And there he is by himself. It's just me and him. He's got the carnation on his jacket. He's smoking the cigarette, and he goes, "Hiya, pal." And he was everything I wanted. I mean, you like you said, it was everything I wanted. So we can talk Honeymooners and Belushi and Godfathers. And I just wanted to say, I know that you like Craig Nettles. But I just want to tell you that Ron Santo, it was the best third baseman in the 70s.
I love him.
In the Hall of Fame. And Craig Nettles isn't. So
he isn't. You're right.
So deal with that there, Artie, and come on. Gee whiz.
Craig Nettles should be in the Hall of Fame. That's great, but Nettles should be in the Hall of Fame for this joke, a little more politically incorrect. Louis Tiant, I just got on the Yankees.
I love Louis Tiant.
Yeah, they're getting on a plane, and Nettles points to a sign on the plane and says, you can't come on this trip, Louis, and it said, no foreign objects allowed.
Oh! And on that note,
laugh it up. What could they do to us at this point?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, on that note, I want to once again thank Artie Lang, who I've always wanted to sit down and talk with, and hopefully we can do this again sometime soon, hopefully sometime in person. I just wanted to plug some things. He's going to be appearing on Crashing, which will be appearing on HBO on January 14th. He's also a part of the Artie and Anthony show, which you go to compoundmedia.com. It's a two-hour live show on Monday through Thursdays. You just can go on there and subscribe. In fact, I just was on there, and if you you can get a 20% off on the subscription if you type in the code ARTIE20, ARTIE20. You go to
Not to interrupt, but or if you know a 9-year-old, you could just steal it.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, people our age, we don't know how to hack, so you got to do it the right way. And I also hear through the grapevine that we may have, talking about hat tricks, your third book might be coming out in 2018. Is that true?
Well, listen, I have a third book that we wrote, and it's definitely going to be coming out Father's Day 2018. It'll be our third book that could be a third bestseller in a row.
Excellent. Very good. Artie, I appreciate you taking the time. As I said, longtime fan and a longtime kindred spirit, and hopefully we can do this again soon. I really appreciate you taking the time. Artie Lang, sweet kid.
This was awesome, man. And when someone told me say hi to Jackie, it was Jackie Martling. So
now, there you go. Right. Well, baby, you're the greatest, and I appreciate it once again.
I love you, man. Thanks. We'll do it again for sure.
All right. Take care, pal.
Get around.
And that wraps up episode 80 of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Thanks to Artie Lang for joining us today, and thanks for Jasmine Cooper for working her magic. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. I hope you had a good time. I certainly did. This is Elton Jim Toronto's Captain Podtastic, the only podcast from the end of the web to your screen.